Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hi, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is a series on Vietnam. This is our second series. We're looking in this series, we're interviewing vets. And so today we have Ken Gamble. Did I do it again? No, I didn't do it again. I was joking around, folks, because I messed his name up the first time. So we are in good shape now. And Ken is a Vietnam veteran, and Ken also has a foundation that has to do with Vietnam vets that were exposed to Agent Orange. And the more I get involved in this series and the more I talk to vets, I find out a lot more vets were exposed to it than weren't, that's for sure, or at least haven't found out at this point, and we'll discuss that a little more detail. But, Ken, how old were you when you first went to Vietnam?
Well, I was probably 19 when I went to Vietnam. I joined when I was 17, but I had a couple of years there that I skirted Vietnam. But I went over there in 1964.
1964, and that was really the beginning. You know, most of the veterans that I've interviewed at this point went over like in that 66 to 68 when things were really being built up. So. What was it like when you, what were your first impressions when you got there to Vietnam?
Well, like I say, the first time we pulled into Chu Lai, and it was at night, and it actually was the 4th of July. And I thought that they were just shooting fireworks off and what have you, but later on I understand it was tracers that I was watching.
Wow.
You know, and this was in 64. This was before mm-hmm. it went from police action to actually a conflict, as they call it.
Right.
But it being a conflict, I would hate to be in a war.
Yeah. I guess it's kind of probably just as well that you thought it was fireworks when you were landing, as opposed to thinking it was actually tracers.
Go ahead. We're just not in sync.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. We've got to work on. When you went over there, you know, one of the questions that Rick wanted me to ask of the vets was, were you kind of ready to go? Were you excited? Were you apprehensive? What were your feelings in that respect?
It didn't play with me either way, and I'm going to tell you why. I joined up. I volunteered. Whatever come at me, that was it. I was in the Navy, and I was serving my country, so it was irrelevant what came at me. Mm-hmm. Because I thought I was doing what I was meant to do, and that was to serve my country. I took an oath, and I lived up to that oath.
And important.
It just did not. I mean, Now, when we pulled into July on the 4th of July and I found out that those they were tracers instead of fireworks, yeah, that scared the heck out of me.
Yes.
I did not, I just figured, we had just went through 6 months of amphibious training, and I couldn't understand why. I had no idea what was going on in Vietnam. No idea at all. Closest I'd ever been to Vietnam was Japan or Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And when we pulled into there, then I found out from then on, it was, duck and cover.
Yeah.
But
I think that it's interesting that one of the things that you experienced was, like you said, the Philippines or Japan. So at least in the Philippines, you probably were used to some of the heat and some of the humidity and, had some feeling of what a jungle was like. A lot of the people that did training for Vietnam went to for the jungle part of it were in Florida and Everglades and places like that. But still not exactly a model. Was it extremely hot when you landed, or was it what was it like when you got off the plane?
I never was on a plane. We took the ship from Coronado.
Okay.
At the amphib base there. We stopped in Hawaii for 6 months, and that's where we did the amphibious training at. In Hawaii. Then we went from Hawaii to Japan, and we went from Japan to the Philippines, and then we went from the Philippines to the living hell.
Yeah. And what were your duties on the boat when you got there?
Oh, I was an electrician.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And by the time that we were finished in Vietnam, I was the senior electrician. I had made rate right up the ladder, and I was a senior electrician on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we did, I can tell you this. Our first assignment was Operation Market Time. We went down to Phukwa Island, which is right off of Cambodia. It's right there at the Cambodia-Vietnam border.
Right.
A little island there called Phukwa, and it was inhabited by the NC, by the North Viet Cong. And there's a place called An Thoi. And we sat there anchored waiting for 9 WPBs. Now, what the WPBs are, they're 80-foot Coast Guard little cutters.
Mm-hmm.
And Operation Market Time was Coastal Patrol. Our job was to keep the Viet Cong off of that island from taking supplies that come down Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Okay.
To stopping them from getting those supplies through to South Vietnam, because they were taking them and then taking them up the Delta and wherever and putting them in tunnels and food, rice, ammunition, guns, everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our job, was to stop that.
Mm-hmm. And how big was this island?
It's just a very small island. If you look at the map, it's just a dot on the map.
Okay.
It's not that big. Well, we did do an assault on it and ended up with 17 KIAs of the North Viet Cong, and we cleared that island eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But
so it could no longer be a supply place. You pretty much wiped that kind of stuff out.
No, it ended up being a place for the swift boats.
Mm-hmm.
Out of there, you know. The guys on the swift boats took it over after that.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not have any any problems with the VC on that island. Mm-hmm. But we supported those boats, those nine boats, for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. Then they moved us up to Bon Thao. And we started a Operation Game Warden. And Bon Thao is at the mouth of the Mekong.
Right.
And then we would see the boat I was on, or the ship I was on, it was flat bottom. It was an World War II LST.
Oh, okay.
Like went into Normandy and all that.
Right. They have all these boats now. Is that like the boat that, I think they have one here in Seattle, and they have them in different places where they've reconfigured them, and they, you know, it has the front end that drops down and for dropping troops and that kind of thing. Is that what the LST is?
Yeah, a long, slow target.
Yeah, yeah, a very long, slow target. Yes, yeah.
Well, it's actually designated as a landing ship tank.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the bow doors open, the ramp comes down, we offload tanks, we offload personnel, we offload whatever. And it was ideal for the boat stations. You know, we could go up the river and we could pull in on the bank and offload ammunition, diesel fuel, whatever they needed, food, so forth, for the boat stations.
Mm-hmm. And they could carry quite a bit, too, couldn't they?
Oh, yeah. They could carry a bunch. I mean, you know, it's like probably a football field down there.
Mm-hmm.
On the tank deck. Of course, this was an old one. The newer ones were different. But we did a lot of running up and down the river and what have you. And we did a lot of, this was after I got out. In 66, we took on two Seahawk choppers,
mm-hmm.
Hueys.
Right.
And we were, at that time, any boat on the river we would support, mostly PBRs, some PFCs, but mostly PBRs, and that's Powerboat River, by the way. And we would send the boats out. They would go up and down the river. If they come under fire, the boats would send the coordinates back to them. The guys would jump in their choppers, the Seahawks, and then they would go out and mortar that wherever they give them the longitude and latitude at,
yeah,
you know.
The coordinates, yeah, right.
And then they would fly back, come back aboard, the choppers would land, and, you know, boats would come back,
so
others would go out. I mean, it was just a constant thing.
Mm-hmm.
Constant thing.
Were you fired on your boat many times, or?
You know, when we first went over there, if you got fired on, it was just small arms, you know, from the banks.
Right.
So it was nothing.
Snipers. Yeah,
just every once in a while. When you first get over there and you first go through this, you're scared to death. By the time that you've been over there a while, you don't even pay any attention to it. I mean, it's just a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had 50 caliber machine guns mounted on the deck on the O1 level and what have you. And, you know, you'd shoot back, but you didn't know what you're shooting at.
Right.
But our only recreation, the whole time I spent from 64 to 66, you know, of course, we were in and out, but we never had liberty. We never got to go over on the beach at Saigon. We never got to go over on the beach at Bon Thao. I mean, we stayed on that ship. The only time I set foot on the ground was when we was up the rivers, and we would find a clearing. When we would find a clearing, we would go to the rec locker and get us a football or soccer ball or whatever, baseball. And we would beach it on the bank, get off, go have us, we would post guards, and we'd have a football game.
Wow.
We'd be rolling around out there in that clearing.
Mm-hmm.
None of us knew what it was, why it was clear. None of us knew why it was clear.
And it was clear because of?
Agent Orange.
Agent Orange, yep.
Where they sprayed. It was, and you know, we would wash that ship down just about every day. And that was unusual. I just couldn't figure out why they were washing that ship down every day. They knew more than we did. They would not let us know anything.
Right.
And then when we were told what it was, of course, you know, they would, those planes and those choppers would go down the riverbank spraying.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, we just thought they're spraying for insects or this or that. You know, we had no idea what was going on. But then after a couple of days and they sprayed, we come back through there and it was all cleared out.
Yeah.
So it made it. That's when we demanded to know what the heck was going on.
Right. Someone one of the people that I talked to, they were working and they were taking the canisters of Agent Orange and putting them in a kind of a big distributor that would go on the planes and on the helicopters to, you know, distribute it on the banks and wherever. And he said, you know, they were, it's just like if you pour a sack of flour out, you know, there's a lot of flour that comes up in the air. And he said they were, you know, pouring these canisters. A couple guys had grabbed these 50-gallon canisters of this stuff and tip it up and pour it into these containers that on the planes. And he said there were just, you know, clouds of this stuff. And he said that the people just were covered in this dust and no masks or anything else.
Well, no. See, we were told it wouldn't harm us. We were told that it would not harm a human being. We were told that it would not harm the land. We were told that it would not harm the water. That's what we were told.
And it did all three, didn't it? I mean...
Well, absolutely. I mean, I was just a kid, green kid over there, but I had enough sense working on a farm to know what the hell, spraying tobacco and what have you, what that stuff would do.
Yeah.
When they got to telling us that, I knew that they was lying to us. Yeah. I knew it.
And it was amazing to me that also some of the folks that worked around the air bases and some of these places that we're talking about, they were amazed that once this was sprayed, literally in 24 to 48 hours, everything was gone. The leaves and everything.
You know why that was?
Why?
That stuff was never diluted down.
Mm-hmm.
It was never diluted down. It was supposed to have been diluted. It never was.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when Monsanto went before Congress and gave them their estimation of how it was supposed to be, Congress said, no, we need it 50 times stronger than that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. Now, we can blame the Monsanto for making it, but we cannot blame them for not diluting it down because Congress was told. They knew. And Congress also told, or the DOD, Department of Defense, put the word out that it was not harmful to humans, and that was the word that we got.
Yeah. And
but you were talking about how they put the drums into the spraying containers, the pumps and what have you.
Right.
I've seen them choppers come over and dump a 55-gallon drum out the door and take the 50 caliber that they had and just shoot that drum all the way down to the ground, spraying it right out of the drum.
Wow.
It's no. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the VA, when we come home, they say, well, you weren't in the spray area. you know, we can't give you any compensation. You weren't in the spray area. What they didn't know was the whole down South Vietnam was in the spray area because of the monsoons would pick that stuff up off the ground, push it throughout. The wind would carry it. You know, it was all over South Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah.
So anybody that was in South Vietnam is acceptable to have Agent Orange.
And I know that even my friend that lives in Ho Chi Minh City now, he's saying that, you know, five generations later, they're still, you know, having birth defects and tremendous serious medical issues as a result of it. Well, let's talk a little bit now. We've got about 10 minutes to go here. Let's talk about your foundation, how you got it started, and then let's also talk a little bit about the museum. So go ahead and talk about the foundation now again.
Okay. I had gone through 46 sessions of radiation, 2.5 years of shots in the stomach. Then all of a sudden, I come up with, 5 years later, I come up with internal bleeding. I had to go into the VA hospital, and I'm laying there in bed, and there's a guy that's next to me, bed over from me. We've got a curtain between us. And he is really moaning and groaning. I mean, he was hurt. And he just kept hollering for him to bring him a drink of water, bring him a drink of water. They wouldn't even listen to him. So I took my water that was on my little table there, and I pushed it over through the curtain to him, and I said, "Here, man, have some water." And he said, "I can't do it." I said, "What do you mean you can't do it?" He said, "They have got to give it to me." And so I took it back. Well, I'm laying there, and he's still, man, just in agony. And I'm laying there looking at the ceiling thinking to myself, why? Why are we suffering like this and not getting any recognition whatsoever? We need this to be out there. We need to have the public to know what's going on. And this is 50 years later, mm-hmm. Okay? So I'm thinking, you know, hell, we'll never get a Purple Heart for this, even though we were injured while in service of our country, and it may have been, as they call it, friendly fire, but that doesn't help the fact that we are all dying from Agent Orange. So I thought, well, if we won't get a Purple Heart, why not an Orange Heart? So I sketched out an Orange Heart. I got out, and I was laying there, and a doctor come in, and I said, "Doc, you get me out of here," because it was. Hearing him screaming and hollering was getting to me, and my PTSD was coming on. And I said, "If you don't get me out of here, Doc, I'm not going to be held responsible for what happens." So he said, "Let me see what I can do." He come back, and he said, "We don't have another room available." I said, "Well, then I'm going home because I don't want trouble." So he says, "I tell you what, if you'll agree to come back tomorrow," he said, "well, this bag that we got on you, just take it home with you, and you come back tomorrow and let us see how things are." Well, I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll do that." Well, I got home, and that little sketch that I made, I got on the computer and had a friend help me, and we perfected it and made the metal. So then I proceeded to see if I couldn't get somebody to make the metal for us. And that took about 6 months to get somebody to make it for us because everybody was scared of it, I reckon. But anyway, we got it made. I started passing it out. I got me a website on the computer and, had an application for them to fill out, what have you, where they're at, and so forth. Same one I'm using today. And, I think the first year I sent 300 medals out to Vietnam vets. From there, I had applied for a 501c3 nonprofit. I got that, and did all the paperwork and everything to get a foundation. So after the first year, it climbed up. Maybe I got 1,000 medals out the second year, maybe I was at about 3,000 the third year, 3,000, 4,000 third year. And right now I'm sitting in this fourth year. We've got 8,550 some odd that I've sent out.
Wow.
And these medals go out to the veterans at no charge. I do not charge them a penny for them. I do not charge them shipping. But the Postal Service is so screwed up. Sometimes they'll say that they owe $3.60 more cents on shipping and all this. It's just a rat race out there with the Postal Service.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And it's interesting, too. I would imagine that, you know, even though you've got 8,500 or whatever medals sent out, that's just
not a
fraction, the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. That's just a fraction of 1%. That's just a fraction of 1%. When I started this, we were dying at 300 a day. Right now, we're dying at 547 a day.
Wow. Wow.
And the expected life, a life expectancy of a Vietnam vet that was in contact with Agent Orange is between 65 and 67 years old.
Wow. Wow. That's a that's
now,
amazing.
You can look at your World War II vets. You can look at your Korean vets. Their life expectancy was in the 80s. Ours is in the 60s. So they've cheated us out of 20 years of our life. There's no way around it.
And there's almost no way that you can't blame it on Agent Orange, just because of the nature of the war at the and what was going on. Well tell me now. I know you've got you're mailing these things out free and everything, And we'll put a plug in for you to get this information out to more veterans. But tell me now a little bit about the museum.
Well, we don't have a museum. We have a memorial.
Right, okay.
What we've done is we have built a memorial. And it's a stone made out of granite. And any Vietnam veteran that made it home is eligible to put their name on this memorial.
Mm-hmm.
We put the name, we put the branch of service, and we put the state that they want represented.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 days ago, I just finished putting the second phase to this memorial. It came in from Oregon, and
Where is the memorial?
It's in Springfield, Tennessee. We're about 28 miles north of Nashville.
Okay.
And it's at 4005 Memorial Boulevard, Springfield, Tennessee, 37172. And we are having a Vietnam Veterans celebration, where we will be reading every name on that memorial off on Vietnam Veterans Day on Tuesday.
Wow.
We're having a meet and greet on Monday at the American Legion Post, and we're planning on. I know we've got a bus coming from South Carolina with about 40 or 50 veterans on it. We've chartered it. We've got people coming in from all over, just like we did when we dedicated the first phase.
And I think that Vietnam War Memorial Day is isn't it April 28th?
No, it's
or March 28th.
March
29th. Well, I only came 1 day off and 1 month off. So
yeah, there you go.
Right.
Well, we've got a good lineup. We've got a Major General for the speaker. We got it's just going to be fabulous. We got a tent for everybody that supported us. We've got United Way. We've got our Chamber of Commerce. We've got two research scientists from Vanderbilt that has been doing research on how many generations this dioxin stays in the body.
Wow! Wow!
And they're going to be there. We've got our veteran service officers. We've got our vet center people that's going to be there. It's just going to be a great day.
Well, it's going to be
80 degrees with the sun shining.
That's good. I wish we had 80 degrees and sunshine here, but we don't. But Ken, it has been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for your service.
Well, I'd rather you tell me welcome home than thank me for my service.
There you go. Well, welcome home too. And let me give them,
if you don't mind, let me give them my email. I mean, my website address.
Sure.
Because there's veterans out there that'll hear this that haven't got the medal yet.
Okay.
It's orange. It's small letters, all one word. It's orangeheartmedal.org.
Orangeheartmedal.org.
Yes, yes. And okay, they can go to that website and apply for the free medal, or they can take and apply for the cenotaph. Now, put their name on the memorial does require a donation of $150.
Okay.
Because we have to pay for that somewhat.
Sure, sure. Well, but that sounds that sounds great. I think, again, unfortunately, I'm sure that number is going to grow. And thank you for, you know, again, thank you for, you know, taking it upon yourself. I think it shows what one person can do if you're committed and really care about something. And so, Ken, thank you a million. And
let me say one thing there, pal.
Yes.
I am 100% disabled veteran.
Okay.
And I'm not going to sit around and mope about it.
Yep.
I'm going to get something done.
And it sounds like you have. And and that is amazing. And Ken, I will be talking to you, and we'll get copies of this stuff to you. And
all right, so, I appreciate it.
So for now, take care, and we will let you go. And this is the voice of Vashon, and we are out for this segment.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.